Yes, yes. Welcome. Faith in a Fresh Vibe. This is a podcast on decolonizing and deconstructing Christianity. I am your host, Ro Hattie, coming at you from Treaty 7 territory in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. This is episode 77, featuring Lamar Hardwick. This episode is one of the most paradigm-shifting episodes that I have on the podcast. If you know me in any way, when I heap high praise, it's for a good reason. Pastor Lamar has a book that has come out called How Ableism Fuels Racism. We dive into the key components of the book, and it gives you a preview for when you need to pick up. Don't forget to rate this show, share it far and wide, just leave a review, pick up the books, and you know what? You can even ask your library to pick up books. Those count. Let's jump into this interview without further ado. The first question I ask all visitors is to situate themselves on the lands in which they are. So, Pastor Lamar, where are you?
I'm in the U.S., in the Atlanta area, actually about Georgia, which in the Atlanta area, which I live in Noonan, which is about 30 minutes south of Atlanta, south of the airport. And it's, from what I understand, the traditional lands of the Muskogee and the Creek is where my family and I live.
I was introduced to your work finding your book, Disability in the Church, which came out in 2021, which was positioned to, I felt, leadership and really getting down into, as the tagline, the vision of diversity and inclusion. How did that book sort of lead into, or they are connected in some ways, but perhaps it didn't lead into the current one that's available this month, February 2024, on ableism and racism?
Yeah, so initially when I set out to write Disability in the Church, it was sparked from, I had just started kind of speaking on the conference circuit for disability ministry conferences, which at the time back in 2016, 2017, 2018, there weren't many of them. But I actually did a talk about disability and diversity. And I talked about how the largest minority group in the world are persons with disabilities. And it's the only one of the very few minority groups that you can actually become a part of at any time for any reason. And so I was making the connection between, slightly making the connection between disability and race. A lot of the work that I do, even the PhD work that I'm doing now, is on the intersection of disability, race, and religion. And so I wanted to introduce that concept. So Disability in the Church was a way to introduce pastors and leaders, but really also congregants, give them something in their hand that's easy to read and something that they could go and give to their pastors and leaders. And in that book, I opened the box just a little bit about the connection between disability and race. But I had a sort of a master plan in mind to sort of write a trilogy of books, Disability in the Church being the first, How Ableism Fuels Racism, the one that's coming out, and then eventually get into more specifically the legacy of the historically Black church and its influence on civil rights, which actually influenced disability rights, and then think about what are some of the things that we can learn and what are some of the ways that even the historically Black church can sort of address its own internalized ableism. So when it's all said and done, it's sort of a trilogy of books that I want to put out, and I'm actually working on the third now.
That's amazing. As you're saying that, okay, here was the plan. I'm going to start off, and the plan was three books, and it's unfolding. That is from like a writer's perspective, from just a visionary perspective. That is awesome. Let's jump into the second one, or the most current that's coming. It's you can order it right now on How Ableism Fuels Racism. Disability is something that is now closer to home for our family as my partner's now disabled, and learning as an able-bodied person of the intersection of disability. And the connection, however, of racism and ableism was not one I had immediately made. And even in my own book, when I spoke of white supremacy and doing just a cursory historical look at the roots, the foundations of the problems that disconnect a lot of folks in church contexts, I name those bedrock components as white supremacy with a side of patriarchy. I had ableism in the mix throughout the book, especially as it was written within the start of the pandemic. But I did not connect the dots in the way that you have. And for that reason, it has become this, your book has become a paradigm shifter for me and has forced me to, it's invited me to think and look at ableism and disability in different ways. There is an opening line and it reads, "The challenge in dealing with racial bias is understanding that racism cannot exist without ableism. Disability discrimination is at the heart of racial discrimination because the actual business of slavery is the business of bodies."
That line, I'm glad you pointed out, is an important line. I think one of the things that I wanted to do very early on, especially as I had been researching this for the last couple of years, is to really ask a critical question. Like, we sort of understand racism to a certain degree. We all saw what was happening in the United States in 2020 in the summer with things like George Floyd. There are some other prominent cases that I bring up very early in the book. And so people were wanting to do their work. But what I saw is that most of the conversations about racism always stopped at, obviously systemically, but even on an individual level, it always stopped at sort of this discrimination against people based on the color of their skin. Yeah. And there's lots of truth to that, but there has to be a reason why that discrimination is held in place, if that makes sense. So it's not just that I look at someone with a different color of skin and decide, you know, they're inferior. There's something about that person, some designation that to which I'm assigning them that gives me this platform for describing them as inferior and describing them as inferior in ways in which they are unable to escape based on this designation that I'm giving them. And so racism then becomes a whole other thing that you've got to just think about. Well, what is it that allowed for, you know, white men primarily to decide that enslaved Africans were inherently inferior? It wasn't just because they had black or brown skin. It wasn't just because indigenous people had brown skin. There was something else that was holding that up. And when you peel back the layers, you start to see that these early definitions of disability that were established as they were colonizing the West became the primary platform for deciding how to designate black and brown bodies in a way that they cannot escape that designation, right? So you think about, it's not that I think I'm superior or I hate you because you're black. It's something else that gives me what they felt was the right to give you that designation, and that was disability. So what you end up seeing is ableism holds up racism. It is this idea that black and brown bodies are inherently inferior because they're inherently disabled. And that's a designation to which white supremacy does not allow those bodies to escape from, which then makes it fuels the economic goals of slavery, right? So now it becomes, even in a lot of ways, it became in their minds, in a lot of minds, a Christian act of charity and benevolence because of this designation of disability, in which they believe that black and brown bodies needed white supervision. So all that plays into, there's got to be a foundation for why this skin color has been given a designation of inferior, and that's ableism or disability discrimination.
I got to pause and then sit with that. And sit with that and sit with that. Because we're all on different places on the spectrum of our connection and understanding of disability and ableism. Some working definition or understanding of ableism itself.
Mm-hmm. Sure. One of the ways I try to simply explain ableism is I actually start off with the two cases I just mentioned. One was of a young Black autistic man named Elijah McClain, who in Aurora, Colorado, was eventually killed after being stopped, minding his own business, walking home, and he was given a lethal dose of a sedative called ketamine, more than twice what someone his size should have gotten. He eventually died. And then there's another case that was not too far from where I live in Georgia, maybe 2 hours away, of a young man named Ahmaud Arbery, who was gunned down by two white men, one who was following in a truck, because they thought he was in an area of a neighborhood he didn't belong in. And initially that case, nobody knew about it for months later because they were allowed to just claim self-defense. So the reason why I bring those two cases up is to try to give a story about ableism. So the basic definition is ableism is, you know, akin to racism, sexism, you know, any other ism. It is basically discrimination against people with disabilities who are not, quote unquote, considered able-bodied or do not possess what society deems as normal bodies. Right. So it's sort of a standard definition. But the reason I bring those, I open with those stories is because what I wanted people to also see is that ableism in and of itself sort of takes upon itself the need to actually also define not just which bodies are best, but which behaviors are best and which behaviors are considered dangerous or safe. Right. And so when you marry that to discrimination against certain bodies that you don't think are quote unquote normal, it expands just beyond a basic understanding of disability, right? Where most times we think of a physical disability or an intellectual developmental disability, and those are certainly true. But what ableism does is it decides which bodies are best, which bodies are where they're placed on the hierarchy or the caste system. And in that, it also takes upon itself the decision to decide which behaviors are considered safe or dangerous. And so when you see a case like Elijah McClain or Ahmaud Arbery, the reason why those deaths and those things continue to happen, and even throughout slavery, even today with George Floyd in 2020, right? It's ableism that decides based on these bodies that we think are inherently disabled, we also hold within and that the power to decide which behaviors are normal, quote unquote normal, and which behaviors are quote unquote dangerous or safe that are displayed from those bodies. And when you hold that power, then you white supremacy sort of gives itself the permission to adjust and act accordingly based on how those bodies behave. We deem that unsafe or we deem that abnormal. And so someone like Ahmaud Arbery jogging through a neighborhood, or someone like Elijah McClain, who are both Black, walking down the street, ableism says we get to decide whether or not your behavior is safe, and we get to decide what to do about that behavior because your body is not normal, regardless of how it functions, regardless of how it, you know, its capacity, regardless of its competency. When you label certain bodies inherently disabled, you also give yourself the power to decide what those bodies should be doing and how they should behave, and the power to also act accordingly. And so this is why you continue to see, you know, unjust killings, because ableism is at the root of that.
you have included aspects so far throughout our conversation around the distinctive pieces that the hierarchy, that whiteness, has described black and brown bodies. Can you draw in what are the aspects to name these clearly and coherently in one space? What are the aspects in black and brown bodies that make them abnormal to the normative?
Yeah, that's a great question. Primarily, just based on my research, it would be, and actually, this it's a very broad thing, so it's hard to narrow down. But primarily, what I saw was what made them, or at least what at least early Puritan culture and theology, as it was establishing the colonies, it was mainly intellectual disability. Now, the reason why that is because if you do a lot of research and you look at how various areas are colonized, even if you talk about indigenous people in the West, there's this sense in which white supremacy labels everything that does not that is not centered on the way that they shape the world as ahistorical. Right. So you look at whether it's indigenous people or African people, this is the reason why a lot of religion was used, because they looked at African traditional religions as something that was barbaric. They looked at indigenous spirituality as something that was barbaric, primarily because they labeled it as ahistorical. These people don't have a real history, a real language, a real past. A real culture, a real society, whereas we have language, we have structure, we have, I mean, that was the ethos of Puritan theology, right? Is this ordered, structured world that they believe that God created. And so everything that didn't sort of fit into that was considered ahistorical, which then translates into, for lack of a better term, intellectual disability. So the vast majority of what colonization used as a way to designate these black and brown bodies was to say that they're intellectually and even in a lot of ways morally, there's moral deficits there, but most of it was intellectual, to say these people are ahistorical, therefore they don't have culture, language, they don't have a background or a history worth speaking of, and so obviously they are intellectually deficient. They don't they're not able to process and think and ration on the same levels as us. And that translates in all levels to talking about emotional deficits, spiritual deficits, moral deficits, right? And so you start to later see physical disability come in, but a lot of that is actually the result of the transatlantic slave trade, just the sheer brutality of how they treated those black and brown bodies. Created lots and lots of physical disabilities, whether it was traveling over from Africa or the ways that they treated the bodies in the beatings and the rapings, those types of things. But primarily, it was intellectual.
I value that you are laying historical foundation for listeners to springboard from, and this is calling listeners to reshape their understanding, not merely around racism, but around disability and ableism and the formation of their own faith, the roots of their faith and how it was formed, the DNA. And I want to take us through, because it goes from history, but we think, oh, that's just in the past, and then bring us into the present. But you have early in the book how even when the abolition movement was underway, that in fact had deeply damaging roots when it came to viewing disability or the disabled body.
Yeah, what I was hoping to show there is that ableism and this idea of disability being something that was problematic, it was something that permeated every discussion about slavery. So it wasn't just pro-slavery who talked about and used disability imagery to justify his position. So abolitionists and anti-slavery. And so they also held pretty much the same viewpoint that black and brown bodies were inherently disabled. Now, they wanted to use that disability imagery and designation as a way of prompting people and encouraging people to end slavery. But yet and still the same, they still had this basic same position. There was never an ethos of equality, as you see throughout that movement. Mm-hmm. Even if you talk about all the way up until, which I don't really touch in the book, but even if you talk about all the way up until the Emancipation Proclamation and freeing the slaves and how Lincoln is considered this great hero, Lincoln himself still didn't believe that black people were equal. He still mm-hmm. believed that they were intellectually mm-hmm. inferior. It was more of a political and business decision, right? And so that just tells you how ableism permeated all of the discussions around blackness, even those who were trying to advocate for the freeing of enslaved Africans used disability imagery. And they also used disability imagery to describe the institution of slavery itself, right? Mm-hmm. And so disability was something, and ableism was something that was used heavily, and disability was something that was looked at as very something that was very negative, right? To the extent that even when they described abolitionists described the institution of slavery, they would use terms, maybe not terms that we would use today that would describe disability, but they would use terms like it's this monstrous institution. They would use terms that are synonymous with intellectual disability or deficits to describe the institution of slavery itself. And so you really could not escape disability and ableism as you're talking about its attachment to blackness, because every person, every organization, everyone involved at the time leaned heavily on disability imagery and language to make their point. I even talk about even there's some internalized ableism that's going on with enslaved Africans. If I talk about some of the fugitive slave narratives, and a gentleman who writes a fugitive slave narrative, and he writes, you know, if you purchase his book, you will receive the blessings of a blind man's prayers, right? And so that just tells you how deeply it permeated the whole institution. And so that's one of the reasons why I tell people that you really cannot separate disability and blackness and ableism and blackness, because it permeated the entire system that brought black bodies to this country from all aspects. And so it is deeply and I don't want to say eternally entangled, but it is it is entangled in a way that is very difficult to separate, because there wasn't any one side that did not use disability language and disability imagery to attach it to blackness.
It would be too easy to take your words and consider them aspects of the past. Mm-hmm. So when you speak of the foundational elements of anti-blackness and the connection points of racism to ableism and a participating church in the midst, and a participating church of the dominant white church in various different traditions, that DNA of the disabled body, or the perception of who is disabled, that DNA doesn't go away with ease. And in fact, I don't know how many churches are in the, when I look here, when I look at contemporary evangelicalism, just to use the biggest example, they can barely have a conversation around racism, let alone disability. When we think of segregation, desegregation, civil rights movements, in what manner is the church still and has continuously perpetuated these harms around a false narrative of that caste?
Yeah, good question. Because you're right. A lot of people will dismiss it and say, well, that was the mid late 1800s, early 1900s. Yeah, yeah. And we, yeah.
Look how far we've come.
Yeah. And so I make careful consideration of that to address it in the book. So there's two ways that I address it. One is actually a legal, a landmark legal case that heavily influenced the church's ability to exempt itself from the ADA. And so definitely want the listeners to get the book. I don't want to give the whole case because it's pretty complicated, but basically there was a case where a family wanted to have their child to be able to use the same funding for sign language interpreter at a private Catholic school that they used the same public funding for. And so it became a whole thing that you can't use public funding in a private school. That's sort of mixing religion and the government. You know, I want to encourage the readers to go ahead and read it. But what ends up happening is both sides of the case end up morphing the case into a case about religious liberty, mm-hmm. Rather than disability rights. It was supposed to be disability mm-hmm. rights. And so what I share is that case actually was maybe a couple of years, not even that far off from the actual ADA being presented. And wouldn't you know it, one of the things that the church used to exempt itself after mm-hmm. sort of being influenced by this case was religious liberty. And so one of the things that I share with people is, whether you realize it or not, that's ableism still at work. Whenever we see current day religious liberty being used as a tool to continue to exclude, that is from the roots of ableism. And so oftentimes it's shrouded in other things, right? And it doesn't always necessarily connect to race, but most of the times it does, right? But if you look at the fact that they took that case that was supposed to be giving rights to persons with disabilities, and instead they made it a case of religious liberty, that has sort of become, if we notice, the banner for all sorts of ways the church wants to exclude people who are different. What I tell people is that's rooted in ableism. Mm-hmm. When people say, where do I see ableism? I say, when you see religious liberty. Mm-hmm. Now, we've done a lot of masking of that, right? But it's still happening. And a more targeted way, I talk about the second part to how I contemporize this, but in a more targeted way, I talk about a famous pastor who, I guess it was maybe 2017, 2018, made some statements about the historically Black church. Those resurfaced in 2020 when especially America was wrestling with a lot of the racial issues. And I'm paraphrasing, the quote is actually in the book, but he basically talked about how the historically Black church is inferior because it teaches inferior doctrine. Mm. And what I share is that that's ableism at work. Because ableism doesn't just discriminate against bodies, it also discriminates against bodies of work.
Oh.
And so if you notice, white evangelicalism always has a problem with anything. I shouldn't say, I don't want to blanket, but most of the time has a problem with any sort of thought or theology that tends to derive from people of color. And mainly liberation theologies, right? And so, you know, I get a lot of pushback sometimes with disability theology, or that's liberation theology. And what I share with people is, can't you see the connection? Now, here's the thing.
Dang.
I say this in the book, that most arguments about doctrine are actually arguments about disability discrimination.
Mm.
Because ableism doesn't just discriminate against Black and brown bodies. It discriminates against the bodies of work that derive from Black and brown bodies. Because if Black and brown bodies are inherently inferior, remember we talked about being ahistorical, not being as intellectual, don't have the emotional capacity, and in this case, the theological capacity. If it's true that that's what white supremacy has built a foundation on, then anything that derives from those communities is also considered to be inherently deficient.
Yes.
And so yes,
must be.
Yeah. It's not surprising then that you would see a pastor say something like that in this day and age, yeah, and talk about, yeah, the deficiency of the Black church, because it's not just about race, and it's not even about doctrine. It's about disability discrimination. It's about saying, mm-hmm, Black and brown bodies can't possibly formulate a meaningful theological, mm-hmm, position because they're inherently and intellectually disabled. And that's, mm-hmm, where that comes from.
Whew. Dang. And as an aside, as you are naming, you are pulling into the light these aspects that are still pervasive within church leadership, within just the ethos and the DNA of dominant Christian traditions in the West. It's why the possibilities of finding new ways of being without first looking for leadership by those on the margins just, mm-hmm, ain't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Another contemporary example that you write about that brings it home into a today moment is the manner how religion and race define health, mm-hmm, or whatever health might mean.
Yeah, and that actually, you can trace that historically, just like I traced the historical roots of early Puritan theology and its definitions of disability, right? And so one of the things that I share with people is that the kind of working model of disability, the definitions of disability that we've all sort of been exposed to were not indigenous, right? Mm-hmm. And so those ideas about bodies and about how bodies should function and mm-hmm, how bodies should contribute to the economic goals of colonization, those were ideas that were brought here. So even, yes, if you look at indigenous people, right, they didn't have the same definitions of what it meant to be disabled. For them, you were only, quote unquote, disabled as far as you didn't have a community to support you. So you see,
yes,
you see a large discrepancy there between between different what world. different worlds, right? Between what early Puritan theology brought and what was indigenous. And it was much more individualized when you start to look at. And so you start to see early definitions of disability forming based on this ideal that was brought over. And so one of the things we have to do first is zoom out and say, for those who were coming over to colonize and start this new world, one of their primary goals was to create a society in which they can insulate themselves from the perceived suffering they had under British rule, right? And so we're going to create a society that insulates us from being on the bottom. Mm. And in order to do that, we're going to create categories and castes so that we insulate ourselves from the perceived suffering that we had to go through, right? And so you start from there to start to see early definitions of what bodies should be doing to help meet those economic and cultural goals. Very early on, you see, if women were unable to have children, they're disabled. If certain people weren't able to meet, contribute to the economic goals, they were disabled. Now, some of it wasn't all bad, but they start to develop these ideas. Well, you fast forward all the way up until post slavery, moving into other things as the country was forming, you see that the church, primarily, you know, religion, primarily Christianity, had a very heavy-handed influence on the defining of what it meant to be healthy, starting all the way back from, we're going to decide who's disabled and who's not.
Yep, right.
And so those definitions started to even shape more when the South was trying to distance itself from the North by saying, we have superior medical and health care because we're able to care for these enslaved Africans and these now free Blacks in ways that the North can't, because we understand their intellectual deficiencies, right? And so what you end up seeing is the church has a heavy hand. One great example, and I list three people that had a heavy influence, but one great example is John Harvey Kellogg. So we all know Kellogg, the cereal, not so great of a guy, but he was a heavy influence in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. He was also a surgeon. He eventually leaves the church because they felt like his occupation as a physician was getting in the way of his ability to lead the church. But at this point, the influence was already set. One of the things that he did, which is still very much the way that healthcare is shaped now, is he believing, like many others, that these now free Africans were intellectually inferior, even anatomically, their bodies were inferior. He thought we have to create a system of health that's going to help us outlive these people now that we can no longer own them. We have to ensure the legacy of the white race. And he created an entire health system that was, check this out, that was designed to make sure and secure the legacy of white women, right? And so because of his influence in the church and because of his influence in medicine, he now has created a whole system for determining what health looks like. But that system was based on ensuring the legacy of white people, particularly the white women, to outlive black people. What we don't often realize is that some of those and many of those same health standards are still in practice today. And the ways in which we decide and determine what healthy is, things like BMI, other things that we still cling to, were never actually standards of health and measurements of health that were designed to help people of color to assess their health. It was designed to ensure the legacy of the white race. So what I share is there's no wonder why you have significant portions of people who are in black and brown communities who always fall into what is often labeled as pre-existing conditions or other ailments that seem to plague minorities. Yeah. Well, when you create an entire health system that wasn't designed to assess their health, you're always going to have brown and black people who seem to overly populate areas. And we saw them with COVID, right? So, here in the States, black people were disproportionately dying from COVID. And one of the terms that came out of this, and this is how Christianity moralized medicine. We start to hear terms like pre-existing conditions and other things that sort of, in the same way where I first started off, give permission to allow black and brown bodies to die at disproportionate rates, right? I even talk about maternal mortality rates for black women and how, why is that still allowed in a developed country? Why do we still allow disproportionate rates of black women to die when giving childbirth? Well, there's a long history of, one, the church having a heavy hand in shaping what health looks like, but also in attaching moral judgments to people who don't fit a standard that was never designed for them in the first place. Yeah. So that's where you get, oh, well, the reason why black women are dying is because they're unhealthy, right? They're inherently unhealthy. What does that sound like? It sounds a lot like how we began this journey with saying black bodies are inherently disabled and inherently inferior. So it becomes very easy to dismiss scores and scores of black and brown people dying from things that, and then the last thing I'll say is the CDC and another organization, I can't remember right now, actually did a study on that to find out, is it race? Is it true that, you know, certain races are just inherently unhealthy? And what they discovered is that it's not race, it's racism. And these are studies that were done in the 2020s. So these are not things from the 1800s or the 1900s.
It's recent.
This is very recent, within last 5 years.
And that ain't right. That ain't right.
No, and it's still happening. Right. Still happening.
Okay, let's pivot. We could spend a whole episode on this. Body, incarnation, Christ. When it comes to the imagination of what this Christian faith can look like outside of white hegemony, and I think of those who have not rooted themselves in either black and some brown indigenous traditions, a reorientation towards incarnation. And what you say, incarnation tells us that bodies have a central role in the practice of faith. Bodies, not the idyllic body, just bodies have a central role. So if we now draw into and you paint the picture of the resurrected Christ as a body for us to look at. Mm-hmm. If we paint a picture now of the resurrected Christ and what clues there are in terms of our way in faith to hold disability well, to hold our own bodies well, what does that post-resurrection body of Jesus mean in juxtaposition as you make this juxtaposition? This isn't white Jesus, the Jesus that we have created to uphold the systemic wrongs and institutions to maintain hierarchy, caste, and all the isms. But this is a very different body that is pointing, even for folks who are working out of those isms and old formation, that you are not necessarily making those connections into the disabled body of Christ. For many, that's a concept rather than a reality, but what the reality of the disabled body of Christ.
First, let me say huge influence from the late Dr. Nancy Eastland, who wrote The Disabled God. Dr. Eastland was actually a professor at the seminary I attended. Unfortunately, I never got a chance to take a course with her before she passed away, but she sort of is a big influence for many of us who are disability theologians. And I pick up her work and expand upon it, you know, particularly being a Black male. One of the things that I say is that, you know, for all religious systems, imagery and symbolism is important, right? It gives us the vehicle to hold a tangible relationship with the divine in ways in which we're otherwise wrestling for language to describe the intangible, right? And so I lean heavily on the post-resurrection body of Jesus as a way to say, this is the God who reverses death but retains disability. Mm-hmm. And in that chooses, right? Because I've had people push back and say, well, Jesus' body is still divine. He can apparently walk through walls. I says, which makes it all more interesting, the choice, yes, right?
Yes.
To come back with these yes. huge gaping holes in the marks of his disabling torture, and to choose to make that the way in which he desires to be eternally identified.
Yes, wow.
You know, even if you look into Revelation, it talks about, and I talk about this in my previous book, Disability in the Church, where he talks about the lamb that was mortally wounded yet still stands. And yet is the only one worthy. And so what I share is that gives us a very unique, imaginative, yet tangible expression of God that we can hold on to as the God who commits to solidarity with the human experience, right, by reversing death, yet retaining right. disability, retaining yeah. and using those limitations that were pressed upon him as a way to be eternally identified as a God who is in solidarity with the disabled, with the oppressed, with the downtrodden, with the marginalized. And this is the way that Jesus desires to be eternally identified. And when you see me, I want you to see my solidarity with the human experience and human limitation and disability and oppression. And that is a very distinct, intentional, but also very tangible and inspirational decision that he makes in order to publicly claim solidarity with the human experience. And so what I share with people is that one of the challenges and why people seem to push back against that is because of our ableism, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I tell people, even if you take the Bible, and most people say they take the Bible literally, but you know, they really don't, right?
You know what they mean, you know.
Right. But I say, okay, so, and I've had this conversation with people who push back on Jesus as a disabled God. I said, well, if you know what a Roman crucifixion really did, not these pictures that we show, right, and if those wounds weren't healed, he was definitely disabled, literally. We can't escape that, that part of it. So what is it in us that makes us want to erase that image of God? Why are we so uncomfortable with the image of a God who reverses death but retains disability? And what I tell them is that is, if you don't know anything about ableism and how it impacts your theology and your view of self and others and God, wrestle with Jesus as the disabled God. Because one of the reasons why we reject that is because of an internalized ableism. And what I share in the book is that Jesus never asked us to fix him, right? So if you think about real quickly, two models of disability. One is a medical model that basically says, and I talk about this in the book, that basically boils disability down to a biomedical issue that is an issue with a person's body and that person alone. Yeah. Yeah. There's something about you that we need to cure, and we need to find out the cause of that, and we need to fix that. Then there's a social model, and I'm simplifying this, but then there's a social model that says that it's not just about the person's biological needs. There is a way in which society socializes with and views disabled people that is often more disabling than the quote-unquote impairment itself. And so what I tell people is that Jesus is very much the victim of the medical model, just as many disabled people are today, right? We need to fix you. We're uncomfortable with the disabled post-resurrection body. And so what I say in the book is we filled in the proverbial holes in Jesus' side and hands with all sorts of ideas don't match the post-resurrection Jesus of the text. And so that's where you get warrior Jesus and winner Jesus and violent Jesus. And we filled in the proverbial holes because we can't abide a God who is disabled. And so we want to fix him. And so I talk about that in a chapter about the rise of the American Jesus. and all that is ableism. We cannot deal with, and in many ways, ableism says that we can't trust a disabled God because people who are disabled are inherently incompetent. And so in order for us to have a God in which we can trust, we need to fix him. We need to heal Jesus. And the problem is Jesus didn't ask us to fix him. He asked us to follow him just the way that he is in his post-resurrection body that bears the marks of disability and is still worthy to be the one who claims solidarity and invites us into, you know, this role in his kingdom of pushing back the darkness. But that's ableism. I tell people, if you ever struggle with whether or not you're ableist, look at the post-resurrection body of Jesus and ask yourself why you are so adamant that those were just wounds akin to a scar from a kid who fell off the bike when he was 8. No, those are holes. Why do we need to, you know what I'm saying? Why do we feel the need to fix him? At the core, it's ableism. Yeah.
You named it. You can't trust that God. And so you make one of your own. The connection is so substantive that it is foundational to the faith that we have sanitized. It's so substantive that Jesus and the solidarity that Jesus chooses to display is one that is firmly entrenched with the margins first. And many can't trust that God. Whew. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Dang, this was so good. I really value your voice. Are there any outgoing or final remarks, thoughts, or things you want to say, shout outs, where to pick up the book and stuff like that, that you want to trail out with?
Sure. I'll just quickly say people can pick up the book anywhere that books are sold. And I'll just share the word. I'm hoping to really sort of make a large impact with this work. So that we can really, really wrestle through, adequately wrestle through some of the tensions that we have with racism, but all sorts of other things that I'll be writing about in the future with other ways that the church has been unkind to bodies that they don't feel are normal.